Welcome back to Irish Illustrated Insider. It is Monday, March 24th, and today we have the full crew. Tim Priester of Irish Illustrated, Pete Sampson of The Athletic, John Bryce of Football Scoop and Irish Illustrated, and I am Tim O'Malley. And since we last spoke, Notre Dame women's have advanced to the Sweet 16 as expected. Notre Dame has had a transfer portal entry from the men's side. They were not involved in the Sweet 16 that we watched four games of non-upsets guys over the weekend, but we also were able to talk some football with Jawan Sider and Coach Gino Gadulli and some early enrollee offensive players and Priesters. Of all those conversations, what's one you'd kind of like to hit on first that stuck with you over the weekend?
Maybe not one that everybody is interested to hear first, but I thought Jabron Payne would be an interesting guy to speak with, and he was. And then you come to find out after talking to Jawan Sider that Sider had recruited him. He kind of fell by the wayside when two guys by the name of Nicholas Singleton and Catron Ellen decided to go to Penn State. Jabron Payne is coming back from the knee injury. There's initial concern when he hears that Dylan McCullough is leaving for the NFL, because that was the guy that brought him to Notre Dame from IU with him. But then in short order, he found out about Jawan Sider coming to Notre Dame. And he's like, okay, well, that'll work, because he had a good relationship with him during the recruiting process. It's just that Singleton and Allen trumped him, of course, when it came to the two running backs that Penn State settled on that season.
You know, from what I found interesting with Sider was, first of all, I liked how frank he was about how much it hurt to lose that Orange Bowl, and how he's like, it affects my family because it affects me, it affects everyone. And it took him a full 5 seconds to jump back into Notre Dame mode when he put himself back in Penn State mode, the pain of it. And I thought when he said, yeah, Nicholas Singleton was going to come to Notre Dame, I got him on the phone as he was leaving Brian Kelly's office and stopped him from committing. I still remember the podcast when Tim Priester's film review of Nicholas Singleton was lost to Penn State Ethosphere forever. And I could see Priester thinking to himself, so that's how it happened.
there were tears on my keyboard the day that he... That was one that I don't normally get so emotionally involved with a recruit coming to Notre Dame, but I just, you've seen him. Yes. I don't need to say anything more.
Yeah, I didn't even, I had a good relationship with you then, TP, and we were friends, but I still remember just casually speaking with you and you talking about, man, this Nick Singleton kid. So that was funny then to have the deja vu experience over the weekend, and for Sider to let you know that he was the thorn in your side.
I said to him, so you were the guy.
Yeah, exactly. And as we jump around here, and I wrote about Kedron Young today, really impressed with him. Loved the insight that he shared with telling me about how his mom made him do push-ups and run and get exercise outside in Texas, and that he attributes like his broad shoulder and his frame to the work that she made them do, not in a gym, but just get outside and get some exercise. And then Pete was there for a lot of it. I was really impressed with Hebert on Saturday when he talked to us there in the IAC. And I'd alluded on the podcast that some folks on campus had told me about Hebert having a really wide base and a good, just being really well put together and large hands. And when you shook hands with him on Saturday, you realize that's pretty darn accurate.
Yeah, he was physically seemed like a mature kid. His interview, I think talking to him, it felt like he had been through media training as well, in terms of sort of like making a non-answer sound interesting. He came across as like older than a 18-year-old for sure. Spent some time with Nolan James Jr. And it was funny recounting the game that I went to see him play without knowing that Notre Dame was interested in him. It was against, I think, Del Barton, right before the Navy game. I've said this on this podcast before, but like when you see him physically, there's probably not a lot that you're like, oh, okay. Like he just sort of looks like a prospect, but not somebody who stands out. But when you watch him play, he plays much bigger than that. So we talked about like what goes into that, in terms of him being a slot receiver and his sort of previous football life and growing to a physical running back. And then, talked to Gino Gonduli for a while and Kenny Minchie as well.
Minchie was great, yeah.
Minchie was really good. And then I think, O'Malley, you asked Gonduli about, I'm not sure if he answered it the way that you meant it.
But it ended up being a good answer.
Yeah, it was probably a better answer than how you intended it to be phrased. But I think you asked something to the effect of, like, when does a quarterback make the biggest gains? And you, I thought you implied, like, what time of year? He answered it, what time of this practice? Where he talked about team periods, which...
Well, he just interrupted Pete. Remember, he's like, team. It's team. Yeah. That's when. Yeah.
It was just like an interesting way to look at everything else that we view in practice, thinking it's important, and him thinking like, no, it's like the team period pretty much like runs the show in terms of quarterback evaluation.
He unwittingly did answer it, though, because team happens in the spring and in early August camp, and team does not happen very often otherwise because they're not allowed to watch them involved in those anything that's going on there. And also, there's not guys, I guess they're not coming to hit you anymore, but there's not 11 defenders running around in the individual workouts or in the summer workouts. So, yeah, not what I meant, but it was a great answer because I put this in Monday Musings. They're going to have half of their team periods the end of spring. Because you don't count all of August camp for finding a quarterback. You only count a couple weeks, right? You're not going into week three of August camp with team periods trying to find a quarterback. So you're going to be halfway to your answer in team periods at the end of spring.
You know, it took me about 90 seconds to insult Will Pauling. You were there.
Shout out to Tyler James, right? You wanted to tell the story, Tim?
Well, he was talking about, you know, because we went to practice on Wednesday and he right away, he's at the front of the pack with the receivers. And he's coming off the metatarsal injury. So we did not expect for him to look like he was full go. And so he's answering a question and he says something about, you know, I'm coming off the injury. And so I follow up with the knowledge in my head that, yes, you're coming off the injury. And I said, yeah, we were surprised to see how quick you were. And I didn't see the look on his face, but Tyler James did. And he interjected. I mean, did you see it? I mean, did you see
it? I did. I just kind of walked in as he was saying it and just immediately bust up laughing. So, yeah.
Tyler James is like, because of the injury, Will. Yeah. In other words, we're not
insulting you. I mean, what did Will say? So I was like, let's see you guys get out there.
Yeah. Anyway, he looked really good. Yeah. And I thought he was a great interview. I'll have a piece on him tomorrow.
Oh, Tim, you know, on Will Pauling, the Devontae Smith part is fantastic. That he went against Devontae Smith.
Oh, yeah. I actually wasn't there when
he went against Alabama and Devontae Smith, and he pointed out a couple things. He's very good-natured in it, but he goes, well, I had 9 catches.
I knew
they were not all on Devontae Smith. But he said Devontae Smith talked so much trash and said something to him so crazy, we have to ask Devontae Smith what it was because he wouldn't say it. So now I'm really interested to talk to Devontae Smith.
One quick thing on Nolan James is Pete and I talked to him, and Pete carried that interview in full disclosure, is that I did not realize his uncle is the running backs coach at Nebraska. And but E.J. Barthel, who has spent some time at Rutgers, Penn State, Nebraska, is a New Jersey native like Nolan. And so he just said he leaned on him a lot, but that his uncle always made sure he made the best decision for him. And as I noted there, his uncle has already had a few different jobs around the sport. So he did not want Nolan to specifically follow him to a place in case something happened and he wasn't there for the entirety of his collegiate career. So I thought that was good perspective that he had a sounding board like that, an uncle who was coaching in a power conference program with a lot of tradition that could give him perspective, but that also would not say, hey, you need to come play for me.
Priester, I talked to Steve Angeli quite a bit. Did you wander over to Steve at all?
I did not. No, I did not.
I didn't know if we're allowed to talk about him because he's not under 20 on this podcast right now. And I know won't be quite as exciting to people, but I have to tell you that Steve Angeli carries himself like he's the starter right now. That my number one impression was he absolutely carries himself.
Gonduli said the same thing, like he expects to be the starter, which he should. I mean, you would certainly hope he wouldn't be in competition for the job if he felt otherwise.
But he was asked kind of bluntly, what are you doing here? And he's like, this is absolutely where I belong. This is where I belong. And Irish Illustrated, we're going to have a feature this week. It was Drew Mentok's idea where we talk about the three quarterbacks. Three of us will talk about the three quarterbacks. We each take one and make the case for, it's not our case. We drew names, but we're making the case for each of the three guys to be a potential starter. And I think that's interesting because you couldn't have done it before with Kenny Minchie, but you guys talked to Minshew, and Gaudioli was just, the way he talks about Minshew is much different than the way he used to. He's like, oh, Kenny is on it now mentally. We're not just talking about some guy that can throw the ball around, which I think was the conversation last spring at this time. Do you guys recall anything with Minshew like this guy could be a starter last year?
I just thought it was much different the way he carried himself. He carried himself during that interview Saturday. He was humorous, but he had a poise and command about him. I mean, it really, honestly, I thought all three of those guys had a presence about them, and Blake had a presence about him on Saturday. I mean, I know I keep going back to that, and he's not a factor right now, but you can see why Notre Dame liked him early on.
Yeah, with Minshew physically, he looks like he's trimmed down a little bit to me.
Yeah.
And I remember writing on him in high school and his teammates saying, being like, that dude loves him some Zaxby's. And thinking like, all right, well, that's something that's probably going to go once you get to Notre Dame. But based on just the way his presence, like, it looks like maybe a little bit less Zaxby's in the diet there, which like he's a really good athlete and he can whip it around and he could throw deep balls in high school. So that's like not new. But I think just sort of like leaning hard into some of his natural athleticism. We'll see. I'm still of the mindset that it's Carr and Angeli, but we'll see with Minshew, I guess. You know, he's certainly a curious character in all this.
To that point, Pete, I just looked it up. So noteworthy. When he arrived, he was 6'1", 5'8 inches and 219 pounds. He's now 6'2". And 206.
Oh, and, wow, that's legit.
You know, he was closer to 210, I think, in last spring. So he has reshaped, but he's added muscle too. You could tell, like, his frame just looks nice, cleaner.
The Notre Dame women's team defeated Stephen F. Austin and Michigan as expected. But I want to ask Pete Sampson, since you were covering the game there, Pete, what was it like to have other people there in the stands when you were covering a Notre Dame basketball game? Was it interesting?
Yeah. So the last time I went to a basketball game at Notre Dame, I also sat courtside, but it was with a ticket and there was nobody else really around me for a men's win over Boston College. This felt like an event. Like, you wouldn't, I mean, even the game on Friday Friday against Stephen F. Austin didn't feel like a game that was a 50-point blowout. Like, frankly, some of the men's tournament games were just like, I'm watching this in an empty gym. But yeah, it was a good environment for both games, and it was. I've been meaning to get to watch them play live, just as a fan of basketball, and I hadn't this year, so it was fun to actually see how quick Hannah Hidalgo is in person, and it's really friggin' quick. So she has been worth the price of admission, or the price of getting a media credential, which of course is $0.
Yeah, they were sharp. Somebody on our board said he was shocked that they played as well as they did. Look, it's still a good basketball team. I thought they were worn out at the end of the regular season in the ACC tournament, and they played Stephen F. Austin, and they beat the daylights out of them. And Michigan's, you know, you think Michigan, but Michigan wasn't that good. And Notre Dame played really, really well. The starters played a ton of minutes, and now they have to play TCU. TCU beat them during the regular season. It was a tournament, actually, in November. They've got some bigs that could give Notre Dame trouble. The Van Lith, the transfer from Louisville/LSU, is on the team, and she's excellent. So it's going to be a real challenge. But hey, they played the kind of basketball that you expected them to play every game all year, because they were a legit one potential two seed. And so it was, you know, good to see them get their legs back and play some pretty sharp basketball.
I want to ask all you guys this, because Pete, you brought it up about empty arenas for men's games sometimes in the first round, especially now with the product being so great on television to watch. Was it 85, Tim, the last time Notre Dame hosted, when they had North Carolina there and Kenny Smith and David Rivers dribbled off his foot? It wasn't 86, because that was Arkansas Little Rock, I believe.
Outside of the NIT?
Yeah, that doesn't count. Except when Kentucky comes to town. That was a fun NIT hosting situation. And 92 was fun. But I really, it's interesting to see. I guess they just lose too much money, but it would be interesting to see host teams for men's in the NCAA tournament again. Because, Pete, that you're right. It just looks like a cool atmosphere. to watch on TV. And they used to do it. I mean, Providence looked better than other places, right? I know they had better games over the weekend, but Providence for men's looked better than other places.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, didn't we spend the entire year extolling the virtues of on-campus playoff games?
Yeah.
And how great they were. Well, I mean, it works for basketball too, and they've been doing it for a long time. So it's, I don't know if it's something that you could do in advance just because you're not, it's unlike women's basketball where you know who's going to be really good before the year starts. I mean, it's somewhat true in men's basketball, but less. Perhaps that's problematic, but I just thought that, especially for the first quarter of the Michigan game, was awesome. I mean, it felt like a Notre Dame Michigan football game in terms of the way the crowd was getting after it. So that was a cool environment to sort of be witness to in person.
Well, that's an interesting comment there, Pete, just because my father-in-law went to his first ever Notre Dame women's basketball game yesterday, and that's the comment he made. Jess took a bunch of her family with her to the game, and he was like, man, I was getting into it like a Notre Dame football game. Mm-hmm. And so I do think that's interesting. You know, the women's tournament tried for years and years and years to have neutral site games, and back when I covered the Lady Vols, I went to a regional in Tallahassee, and once Florida State got upset on the first Friday, and it was the Lady Vols and I don't know, Oklahoma or whomever on the Sunday game, like it was more quiet than a library. Like, you had to tell people to be quiet when they were whispering. So it's just not been able to sustain itself for the women to have the neutral site games in these opening rounds of the NCAA tournament. And then Notre Dame has proved all year long that, by and large, it's a vastly different team at home. It played exceptionally well. I know the bench is the bench at this point, but when you win by 52 points on Friday and you pretty much led by 20-plus the duration of yesterday, I still think it's problematic when you have Sonya and Hannah that played 35 and 36 minutes on Friday and 32 and 31 minutes yesterday.
We had a few basketball questions on the men's side as well, so we'll save those for segment two, guys, including now two portal entries for Micah Shrewsbury's Fighting Irish. Looking to upgrade your wardrobe? Founded by Notre Dame alum Go Wang, you've seen ESQ's custom clothing on the player walk and all of your favorite players and coaches. With more than a decade of making the best bespoke clothing available, ESQ will help you look and feel your best. From a perfect-fitting suit or sport coat, shirt or bomber jacket, or that perfect tuxedo for wedding season, check out esqclothing.com and book an appointment to upgrade your wardrobe today. Mention Irish Illustrated and get 10% off your entire purchase. That's esqclothing.com. We'll be back with segment two, Burning Up the Boards.
This is segment two, Burning Up the Boards. We have a question from Shibe43. With the football roster needing to get to the 105 player limit, is there a potential hidden benefit of the retooling of the recruiting staff? My thought is that new sets of eyes on players with little emotional connection to them through the individual's recruiting process, it potentially could make the unfortunate roster cuts more business and less personal.
Yeah. Go ahead, JB.
I was just going to say, I think that's something we very much talked about. The term I've used is dispassionate, and a really good friend of mine who just got a new FBS GM job said that the coach called him and said, man, I can't wait to get you here because we need objective, not subjective. And that's the best way to put it. It's absolutely going to that model. And I think that we all have to get comfortable with the fact that guys are not going to be making four-year decisions moving forward. It's going to be a lot of places are doing two-year or intend to do two-year revenue share agreements, and then they'll revisit everything after that. And if you're really freaking good year one, you probably can demand to have that revisited before year two. And if you're
like
not
Leonard, like Leonard Moore, maybe, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like Ben Morrison in this environment couldn't name his price, honestly, after the freshman year that he had. So yeah, that's a great question. That's something that we probably haven't done a good enough job of outlining, but yeah, Mike Martin knows dispassionate because that's what the NFL is. It is absolutely does not care about your feelings. It's the no feelings league. So that's the approach that a lot of places are taking, will be taking, and already are implementing.
And they need that because coaches are terrible at this. Yes. There was a good story in The Athletic O'Malley, maybe you read it on the San Francisco 49ers and they're remaking of the front office. And there's anecdotes of Kyle Shanahan running into Jed Yurk's office being like, we have to re-sign Brandon Ayuk, and did the same thing with Deebo Samuel. And like, it's a terrible way to do business. So that's where you need your GM or your owner. I guess Marcus Freeman would be the owner in this case, making more calculated decisions. And I think it's really going to suck for this first year.
Yeah. It's way different this first year. Cause you're cutting a lot.
Yeah. Cause this first year I think is going to be really harsh for walk-ons. I feel bad mostly for Marty Biagi. Cause I feel like he's going to bear the brunt of this the most. With the number of walk-ons who are actually specialists, and you probably just can't keep the room the way that it has been in the past. But in the future, it's a more of a financial, in the present too, it's a financial decision about like, hey, who gets what money and how much. And that's going to be a hard, never ending conversation to have too.
I mean, coaches are human too. You know, I mean, they spend all their time relationship building with the players that they're position, and now this has come about. So yeah, you do have to be dispassionate, as JB said. I think Mike Martin, every time we talk about Mike Martin, I think, you know, I'm always bringing up how many boxes he checks. That's another one that he checks, because he was in the professional business of the NFL, and those were the decisions that had to be made. Now the walk-ons that Marty Biagi loses, you know, he's going to get scholarship players to replace them on his units.
Yeah, but they're somebody not better at it, maybe.
Well, maybe not. No, maybe not. But again, it's a changing world, and they're going to have to be better at it because you won't have all the walk-ons to rely upon.
I wonder if it is good business to get rid of your better. I don't think you get rid of your better walk-ons. I think you get money off the books by getting rid of some scholarship players you don't want. I don't know why you would want the 95th scholarship player when you can make him the best walk-on. Like I do not imagine that as a good business decision either.
I'm with you on the idea that, you know, your scholarship limit can go up to whatever you want. Like, does Notre Dame really have more than 85 scholarship worthy players?
Not that they want. Yeah, they'll get a couple, but yeah.
But I think moving forward,
Not right now, they don't.
But moving forward, and again, we've noted this before, but let me note it again. I was told by folks on campus that Notre Dame will add 19 total scholarships to athletics for 25-26, with 10 of those designated for football. Now, one other important thing to note that I mentioned on here before, and talked to some additional ADs and compliance people about it. You have the ability for partial scholarships moving forward, or equivalency scholarships. So technically, you could have 95 full scholarships, but 105 guys could be getting some piece of a scholarship as part of their academic package being on the Notre Dame football team. So, but that's my understanding that Notre Dame will fund 95 football scholarships.
And that will be very appealing to walk-ons, and also a junior that was going to be asked to leave the team, for instance, because you just couldn't justify it, where all of a sudden you are one of the 105, but you're not on a full scholarship anymore. I mean, that's the reality too. Now this year stinks for anybody. This is a different year. It's a great question. And I'm glad it happened. I'm glad it was brought up, because literally when they hired Chad Bowden to be the GM, which they had to do, the first thing said on this podcast was, now they need to get a GM and let him do his job as a recruiting coordinator. We literally brought it up the day it happened, because you're a recruiting coordinator. You build everything on relationships. You cannot be the guy
it's a good point.
Deciding to cut someone.
Yeah. This is going to seem cruel. I mean, we start seeing it is going to feel cruel. And next year, the year after
a little less.
Yeah. It'll be more like, you know, business as usual.
TP, I feel like you know this well, though. There have been cuts in college baseball for quite some time. It's maybe just it doesn't get the attention. But
no,
it doesn't. I don't think it's very uncommon at all for a kid to come in and fall ball as part of a new program, and then he's not very good in fall. And when winter break hits, the coach starts saying, your best bet is going to be to go ahead and transfer out of here, or you can finish this year and you need to plan on playing your baseball elsewhere.
And it's happened in football all over the country. Notre Dame is just extremely sensitive to it when it happens. It's happened in the past. Like, we could throw up a name now because he's 11 years away, but Niles Sykes showed up at campus in the summer, and the regime that was there at the time said, you might want to look to play somewhere else. And he was at IU before his freshman year ever started. It does happen. It's really rare at Notre Dame. It cannot be rare this time. It has to happen at Notre Dame for at least one and a half, probably two cycles. So you probably got to whittle down for a couple cycles, and then they'll figure out how they're exploring the new world. From the Salty Jazz 14, great name for a great name. Who are your picks for the highest ceiling in 2025 outside of the obvious? Jeremiah Love and more.
I'm going, like, I don't know if this means, you know, everybody on the team.
Everybody. Does it mean, because Love and Moore are probably the highest ceilings, right?
Among the grad transfers, you know, I would say Devontae Smith, Malachi Fields, and Jared Dawson. But among, you know, the rest of the players, Bryce Young is right there at the top of the list. Kirby Lambert, KVA. You know, I think Traore has a chance to be a sensational pass rusher. We already saw that a little bit last year. And wouldn't most people start with CJ Carr as the guy that has the highest ceiling? He'd certainly be up there with most of the people that we would list, I would imagine.
Yeah, I think in the quarterback room that the consensus is CJ Carr absolutely has the highest ceiling. I like your pick on Traore if he comes back fully explosive and healthy. I walked by Gabe Rubio the other day, and I'm still just impressed at what he was able to do and how much he was able to give Notre Dame as last season wore on to the longest season in Notre Dame history. And that was a guy who hadn't been around the program all spring. So really impressed by that. And I still think I'm big on Greathouse. I think he's the best pure wide receiver on the team.
I'd go Traore. Like, if it was like, because what's potential? Like, who's going to be a who are the first round picks on this team?
Bryce Young can be a first round pick.
Bryce Young could be. I think Traore could be. I'm not sure I would agree with, like, the other guys I don't see as like that level of potential. But I look at Traore and I really think he will have a end of junior year decision to make if it goes as well as everyone hopes that it does.
KVA.
And he is number one for me. He's gonna be the best defensive player on the football team next year, not named Leonard Moore.
And I would throw another name out for a guy that he did play a little bit last year and he dropped a touchdown pass, but Micah Gilbert, I think, is a guy that I think the Notre Dame staff looks at Micah Gilbert and it's like, okay, he's going to be a top of the line wide receiver for them. You know, we can speculate about Will Black and, you know, those guys, but that's just, we're still going off of high school reputation and high school film. And
Will Black, James Lanick. Yeah. I apologize, TP. I'm terrible for that. I do think Adon Shuler is a guy, like, when you look at this Notre Dame team, I'm with Pete. Like, how many guys do you pinpoint and say, I believe he's a future first round pick? But I look at this Notre Dame team on both sides of the ball and think they've got a lot of really freaking good football players that can position themselves to be draft picks. And I think Shuler is in that category for sure.
And I agree. He's not a first round pick. This one I'm going to say, cause it's the wrong position, but Priester brought it up recently. Might've been the last podcast. Jadarian Price is now completely removed from that injury. He had one flaw last year, got caught up too much at the line of scrimmage every once in a while. I would probably be the number one thing he has to work on for a new coach. Jadarian Price has a high upside, man, because when
he's a smart and mature kid. You know, I know people are pushing for Aeneas Williams, and we all love what Aeneas Williams can do, but Jadarian Price is a very bright, mature kid. And when remember when Sider asked for them to make a list of things they need to improve upon, I have no doubt that Jadarian Price put that at the top of his list. So they got a great group there.
From It's Abby, Be Happy. You guys have mentioned a few times that Angeli is likely to be a captain candidate, but won't be if he isn't QB1. Is this a team rule or just something you guys believe in? Or because if he's QB2, he's likely to transfer? If he's a great leader, stays and gets the votes, what's it matter?
Yeah, I don't think there's a rule to it, but
just find it odd where your backup quarterback's the captain.
DeShone Kizer was named a captain and then he left. It's a different situation. I think it's just, you know, I won't speak for you guys, but from my perspective, it's just something that you tend to believe in. If he is QB2, he could very well transfer after the spring. You know, I mean, he's everything that he's done, he's earned the right. I just don't know which direction they would go in a situation where, you know, Carr starts and he stays.
He's voted a captain. That's your point, right? Carr starts, yeah. He stays, and he's voted a captain in August. But if it's a landslide vote, he's a captain.
Yeah.
And yeah. I just think you got to listen to your roster. Like, we can have all the rules we want on this podcast for voting captains. None of them matter. If your roster says it's Steve Angeli, then it's Steve Angeli, whether Marcus Freeman agrees with it or not, frankly. And I know you guys talked about, I think it was on the last podcast, and so Tim, I think you put Bryce on the spot about who was going to start, and he refused to answer the question, it made for good listening. But I like, that's why I think Steve Angeli is going to start at Miami. It's because the locker room views him as QB1 and a captain right now. And I think it's kind of one of, if you possession is 9/10 of the law, like he's the guy that the locker room views as like, this is our guy for now.
I want to ask Marcus Freeman about that. And here's how I want to couch it. Because remember when the season started and this is the starting offensive line, Pendleton was in the starting lineup and Freeman said, this is who we feel gives us the best chance now. And that could change down the road. Do you approach, and that was offensive line play, Do you approach the quarterback play the same way? I know we've had some subscribers say that would be crazy. Not if Carr's your best, you start him in game one. It's very many times it's difficult to know who your best quarterback is in camp. I know you put him through the paces, but it can be really, really close. I just want to know what Marcus Freeman's answer is, that if you said that about the offensive line, would you do that at quarterback as well?
Next question from Donnelly, 3434. Rank the projected future production of these four players at Notre Dame. And I'm going to throw in, he means career, okay? Not next year. KK Smith, Logan Saldate, Cam Williams, and Micah Gilbert, four wide receivers.
Go ahead, guys.
I'll go Micah Gilbert, number one. I will go Saldate, number two, and then I'll cheat and say that KK Smith and Cam Williams sort of tie. But I think Micah Gilbert is just my clear one and poised for extreme production at Notre Dame.
I would agree with that. I think it's a good ranking.
I would go Gilbert, Saldate, Williams, if you can give him another year. And then KK Smith. I'm not going to cheat with the tie. I'm going to go ahead and go in that order.
Well, nobody likes you, so that's why.
Gilbert's my one. Saldate's my two. Like, if we're talking about this year, I'd put KK Smith three. We just need to. I know people get frustrated with the Jordan Johnsons of the world, the Cam Williams, but he just hasn't flashed yet. And
they have a much different outlook on their college life.
Oh, and there's no doubt about it. I've actually written that the Williams is more coachable and a better fit for Notre Dame by far than the other receiver that I referenced from the past. But Williams has the ability, but we got to see it. I've got to see it with my own eyes to put him higher. Question from Not Jay Tafel. Considering Marcus Freeman is a defensive minded head coach and has admitted he doesn't know much about offense, who has the final say in choosing the starting quarterback? Guduli, Denbrock, or Freeman?
I think it's committee. I think it's the three of them. Marcus may not – he sits in on some of the quarterback meetings, so let's not act like he's defensive-minded and chooses to not learn about the offense. He's very much invested in the offense, and to his credit, I think Marcus Freeman is always seeking to improve and always seeking to evolve and learn. And so I think he spends significant time improving his football knowledge in that regard. And he does that outside the building as well. He's visited with some NFL coaches, quite certain. He spent some time last year with Sean Payton at length. And so, and Payton's considered an offensive guru. So I think that it's a three-man decision. I think that the play will speak for itself. Those guys can, you can think those guys want who they want, but this will absolutely be the ultimate meritocracy with who proves it on the field. And if one guy plays so damn well all spring that it's undeniable, everybody will know, and it would be coaching malpractice not to acknowledge that.
I think Freeman ends up breaking the ties too. Like, here's the case for Angeli. Here's the case for Carr or Mitchie. Freeman listens to those cases. Yeah, but what about this? What do we need more? We need this from our quarterback. And I think they know more about that when they know what type of offense they're going to be. I thought Sider made a great point in his interview. He was like, I don't know how many quarterback, I don't know how many running backs we're going to play. It's not going to be as many as McCullough liked to play. He said, I can barely play four. He said he had trouble playing three at one point, but he's going to have to here. He's like, we don't know what we have. We don't know what offense we're going to be. Are we going to be three tight? Are we going to be two tight ends? Are we going to be three receivers? They don't know that, which is a story for another time, because I don't know how they can be two tight ends if they don't bring another tight end. But that's a story for another time. But I think Marcus Freeman might really be breaking a tie if it's not an obvious choice. It might just be an obvious choice and there's no tie to break.
I think, you know, to the point of like, we don't know what type of offense we're going to be. Well, Denbrock gets to decide that, not Gaudioli. And yep. So I would think that Denbrock would have more sway than the quarterback's coach, even if the quarterback's coach is more intimately involved with the competition itself. So yeah, maybe Freeman breaks the tie on that. I don't think there's going to be a tie to be broken, though.
I think it's a three-man conference, but it better be Marcus Freeman making the final decision. I can't imagine it would be anything other than that. And look, he's
Denbrock could be more involved in that than the head coach.
Well, I know. I'm not. Of course, he will. That's why I say it's a three-way discussion. And I'm not saying that Marcus Freeman will take into account what they say. Like if Denbrock is saying it should be this guy, and Freeman's thinking it should be this guy, does Freeman allow himself to be swayed in that direction? Well, that's what a good leader does if he truly trusts his offensive coordinator. But
I think I was thinking of back to 2018 when they made the switch from Wimbush to Book. I think we all sort of know how that happened. Like, it wasn't Brian Kelly's idea necessarily. Right. It was Chip Long's.
Right.
So I think I've just got the offensive coordinator stuck in my brain of like, the offense needs to change, or our offense needs to go in a different direction. Like, this is the quarterback to take it there. So the OC sort of needs to drive that a little bit more than the head coach.
Sure. And then the head coach has to be objective about it and say, all right, man, I trust your judgment.
Yeah. Cause it was a big call, right? Like,
that's... yeah, I mean, that was, and it was the right call. It was massive. And I remember Book's first start. It's like, okay, that made sense. That was his first start after he was elevated.
Wake Forest. Yeah. The Wake Forest game.
Not North Carolina from the previous year.
Well, that was an easy press conference for Brian Kelly. They scored about 100 points and Book had four touchdowns. Yeah, I decided I made to make a change.
Genius.
If it didn't go that way, it would have been a little different for him.
Yeah, maybe the better sidebar to this question is like, whose fault is it if it goes wrong?
Yeah, yeah.
Quarterback's coach, the OC, or the head coach?
The head coach.
Yes.
It's all because he allows it. Yeah. He allows it to happen. We're kind of dealing with semantics there. We have a question from the Irish Gambler. The start of the 25 season has included major front office changes, the departure of a monster defensive coordinator, and the Irish could still lose significant talent in the portal. The spring season feels more active or hectic. Is this the new normal? Is it a one-off, or is it just Irish Gambler's imagination?
I would contend that overall Notre Dame had a pretty mild offseason. I mean, look, when you see that Purdue had what, like 29 newcomers in the portal, and I don't remember how many that went out of the portal, and Notre Dame lost Al Golden and lost Dylan McCullough, but didn't lose Mike Mickens, didn't lose Gino Gaudioli, didn't lose Max Bulla. I think that this is far closer to the new norm, and I think change absolutely is the new norm, and especially until they can settle on whether or not there will just be one transfer portal date. And it's important to note there's still ongoing discussions about the length of the window. Can there just be one window? Will there be two? There's a lot of support for just one window. And that's the next discussion that could shape how the portal is viewed at the end of 25 going into 26. And then, but beyond that, like I'll always say it, if you don't have people that want to hire your assistant coaches, you're probably not going to be the head coach for very long. Like, you better have people that other people want. And so I think that when you look around the country, I mean, Ohio State lost both coordinators and lost coordinator to an arch nemesis and an arch rival because things had so soured there. And so I think you give Marcus Freeman and Pete Bavakwa a hell of a lot of credit for the overall stability.
I would say that Irish Gambler is living in a world of pure imagination. Yeah. Like, there's, this is, I think, been a pretty tame offseason. And I don't think that Notre Dame is going to lose significant talent to the portal moving forward either. So, two assistant coaches, like, look, these, I know we spend a lot of time on like the back of the house staff, so to speak, at Notre Dame. They change all time. And like, one good person leaves, they're hired by another good person who will then leave in another year and be hired by another good person. So I wouldn't confuse change with like
disarray,
chaos, or disarray. Yeah. Like, it's just change.
Two off seasons ago, they lost Reese, who is not as good of a coordinator as Al Golden, but they lost Reese on what, March? Where into March did Tommy Reese decide to leave?
Like the first week or so.
Yeah. And Sam Harmon didn't have a.
It was February.
No, it was February. They didn't. Yeah, they didn't February. Get their. Yeah. They didn't hire their guy. Sure. They didn't hire their guy for Sam Hartman until March. They lost in the portal window, which was different then. Four of the five best recruits from 2021 going to their junior years. They only kept Blake Fisher. They lost Tyler Buckner, Prince Colley, Lorenzo Styles, and Logan Diggs. That is a rough spring. Who they lose this spring? I mean, can you name a person they lost this spring? Like, well, last year they lost all of their receivers. They lost all of their receivers last year.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Right away. Right away, too.
They lost everyone.
And their wide receiver coach.
This is just the first year, I'm glad Pete brought this up, that we care about the administration and back of the house staff and stuff like that. Because first of all, it didn't exist a couple years ago. There was no GM. They named Chad to be the GM because they needed to keep him. They said, okay, here's a good idea. Here's a position, GM. Those things just didn't matter. I think this has been so calm compared to what could have happened. Part of it's the 95 scholarships. I bet you 10 more guys would be gone right now if not for the 95 scholarships.
Yeah, that's
thing.
True. Yeah, okay. I'll throw out one name to prove that it's been a calm offseason. Andy Ludwig. They didn't go through an Andy Ludwig situation. And, you know, Chad Bowden, that was a guy that did a lot of great things. But if you add it all up, there's every day seems like a week for people with angst about replacing him. But when you add it all up, Mike Martin and the staff, it came together in a matter of a few weeks. And so
they lost all-time great coordinator. Frank Broyles winner is different than losing Reese and Laurinaitis. I get that. Like, that's totally different. But if you were following Irish Illustrated, you knew he was leaving at some point.
Yeah, exactly. And Freeman knew who he wanted as his defensive coordinator. Yeah. He talked about it when we asked him about it a couple weeks ago that, you know, he's known Chris Ash for a long time. And so he pinpointed him pretty early. There were some other guys involved early on, but yeah, if this is the new normal, I will take this because January and February can be a hell of a lot more chaotic than it was this year.
Next question from Phil Affell. How much full scrimmage, good on good, do you think will occur this spring given the, and he puts it in quotes, truncated rosters? Will there be much except for the Jersey game? I'm most interested to see how the ND wide receiver room performs versus one of the better secondaries in college football. And although truncated might not have been used correctly there, I appreciate the reference to our new podcast word. So that is great.
Go ahead, TP.
No, go ahead, John.
I was just going to say, I think there'll be a decent amount because Marcus Freeman wants a tough physical team and he believes in it. And they're staggering guys in, so you're not going to have a hellaciously physical day on a day that Jeremiah Love is full tilt, but on a day that Jeremiah Love gets the Barry Bonds recliner, then yeah, you're probably going at it. And you're still trying to find some starters on both sides of the ball in some very key positions. And you can't do that in football without going live full tilt, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think when we see the jersey scrimmage in, what, 2 weeks? We're going to get that. We're going to get a physical practice, but we're not going to get a physical practice with Jeremiah Love or Emile Wagner or Drake Bowen or maybe a Don Shuler. And that's fine. But I do think that they, you know, Marcus referenced this the other week. Like,
he did.
The truncated rosters thing is like, I guess it's just, it's truncated from fall, but like, this is, their spring roster isn't really that much different than a standard spring roster. It's coming off a 16-game season instead of a 13-game season.
Yeah, like last fall, they were doing the two spot, so they were basically getting double the production out of every fall preseason camp practice because they had enough depth to be running on concurrent fields going 11 on 11. So you had 44 guys working against each other at all times. You're not going to have that in the spring, but you're still going to get good on good. And as Marcus alluded to, you know, the third team on the third team is still good on good.
Yeah. He literally said the thing about the spring is you have to go good on good because you don't have scout teams. Like, I don't think people understand how much there is scout team once August 15th hits. Like, someone will ask in like mid-September, do you see this freshman wide receiver working his way in? I was like, probably not, because he's on the scout team running the other team's plays. And that's just not a thing in the spring. And as JB said, I don't care if you go ones versus ones, twos versus twos, threes versus three. It's good on good. This is not scout. You structure your practice to have good on good in the spring.
Yeah, I was just a quick point to illustrate what O'Malley's saying is, like, when I went to Miami of Ohio and actually watched like an in-season practice in late September, there was no good. There's no good on good. Like, it's all just like starting offense over here, starting defense over there. You're working against a scout team. That's it. Like, that's the whole practice. And I think that's probably true just about everywhere.
Yeah. And I, you know, remember, we know the guys that are going to be limited this spring. So there's plenty of reps for Jabron Payne and Kedron Young and KK Smith and Micah Gilbert and Cam Williams and Logan Saldate and Jerome Bettis Jr. and Scrap Richardson and Elijah Burris and Joe Otting. I can go, you know, the usual suspects. You have three freshman offensive linemen, early entry freshmen, Styles Prescott, Peter Jones. You know, there's plenty of opportunities to be really physical. You're just not going to do it with Jalen Snead and Drake Bowen and, you know, the usual suspects, the guys that we know that put in a season and a half this past year. We have a question from ND Dan 106. How many changes will Notre Dame basketball go through this year with coaching changes and player transfers? JB mentioned Notre Dame's commitment to have a top five paid football staff. Will they make the same investment to men's basketball to get them back in the tournament sooner rather than later? And then he also asks about other sports, baseball specifically. I can talk for a bit about that.
Baseball stat that I want to throw out when we get to the baseball, because that program
is it a
52, that program is an insult to Wiley Coyote.
Is it a 50? It's a 52% strikeout rate against conference competition.
All right, well, I want to quote. I want to quote Homer Simpson here. Is that a good siren? Is that a good stat you're going to set out for us?
No, it is not. But it's the most damning stat I can think of or could find, and it just bothered me because Priester and I used to sit out there and cover Link Jarrett games.
Enjoy life.
Link Jarrett will be back in town this weekend.
That's what I heard. So anyway, guys,
Declan's baseball team will be on the field for that game.
Awesome.
They are 1-8 through 9 ACC games this year after finishing 9-21 a year ago. They lost their last four ACC games of Stifler's first year. They are 10-32 in their last 42 contests against ACC opposition. That is beyond pathetic. And so that program is an absolute train wreck right now. There's no other way to say it. People who listen to this pod regularly know I'm an MLB fanatic, but also I've never seen college baseball on the whole better than what it is across the country right now. I can't believe how the bottom has fallen out of this Notre Dame program in such short order from the halcyon days of Link Jarrett that were, by the way, just 3 years ago. And well, so I will say that. And then I would just say on basketball, look, like, Notre Dame gave Micah Shrewsbury, I think, a 7-year deal and made a significant financial commitment to him. The ROI has not yet been there through 2 years. Notre Dame has paid a guy like a Marcus Burton and paid other guys NIL money. That's why they played in the tournament in Vegas in November of this past year to get an extra guaranteed $1 million for NIL funds just for the basketball program. So I think, yeah, there's two guys expected in the portal. It's worth noting that as we record this around 1:30 to 2:30 on Monday afternoon, the only Notre Dame player officially in the portal that's eyes on the portal right now is J.R. Konecny. We all know that Tay Davis is anticipated to go in there, and it's been widely reported. But as of right now, right before I logged on to this podcast, J.R. Konecny is the only one officially in the portal. I would anticipate a couple of staff changes in men's basketball as well.
Marcus Burton, of course, has a decision to make if he wants to play in the NCAA tournament before he leaves college or wants to stay at his hometown Notre Dame. As it relates to Notre Dame baseball, I mean, what can I say? I will say this. They got no breaks when it came to the scheduling when they had to open at Wake Forest, at Clemson, and then Georgia Tech came to town. They haven't played any of the northern teams like Pittsburgh and Boston College, what have you. But I was at beautiful Frank Heck Stadium yesterday, and it's a disaster. It is a disaster. They are barely competitive. They're striking out in conference play at a 52% of the outs made. 52% of them are strikeouts. They regularly strike out 12, 14. They struck out. It was against Clemson. Maybe Wake Forest, where it ended in seven innings and 17 of their 21 outs were strikeouts. They are not a good baseball team.
You guys are saying that it was not a good siren that JB was going to bring up there.
No, nope. Okay. Nope.
No, it's a disaster siren. It's the tornado siren.
As it relates to the question about, you know, hiring assistant coaches, it's different in football than basketball. You have offensive coordinator, defense coordinator that significantly impact the game. Mm-hmm. Assistant coaches in basketball, just the nature of the comparative two games, you don't influence it the way an Al Golden is capable of influencing it. So that's kind of an apples and oranges kind of thing.
Next question is from ND Fullback Fan. That's a great name. Give me your top three ND Pro Day standouts for later this week. But we have some of the same ones.
Yeah, Jack Kaiser, because he will
test well.
I mean, he did at the combine. I don't know exactly what he'll do. I'd put my money on, if you made me limit it to three, I'd put my money on Xavier Watts and Mitchell Evans with Riley Leonard. He needs to throw it well. He needs to throw it very well. That will be heavily scrutinized.
Yeah, I like Watts. I like Mitch. I think Mitch is being undervalued in this draft a bit because of some of the shine on a couple of those tight ends that are rated more highly. But I think Mitchell Evans has the mindset, the aptitude, and the athleticism to be a 7 or 8 year NFL guy, in my opinion. And then I think Riley Mills will have some pretty ridiculous strength numbers and do some other positive testing.
I think I feel like Bo Collins will come. There will be like, if Bo Collins tested at the combine, this would have been in the top 10%. Like,
yes,
a lot. Bo Collins should put up some really good testing numbers. I feel like Bo Collins is kind of made for an event like this. So other than Jack Kaiser, Bo Collins would probably be my number two.
Yeah, I'm going strictly testing. I think Jack Kaiser, Bo Collins, and Riley Leonard. And I think Riley Leonard's broad jump and vertical leap are going to be something that people look at and are wondering why it's so much farther than other people's, because I've seen that guy jump. And I mean, on a football field too, when he's running, and he travels a great distance. Mm-hmm. When he does that. Priester, I wanted to bring this up because there's no chance to ever do it again. When you talked about the college basketball versus college football, and of course, college football assistants are so much more important. There's one exception, because it just came across the Twitterverse over the weekend. The 1986 Kansas Jayhawks basketball staff. Have you seen this?
No.
Larry Brown, Greg Popovich, Bill Self, Alvin Gentry, and then R.C. Buford, who was an NBA executive. Those were the guys.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
But they didn't win it until 88 when most of those guys were gone. So there you go.
Yeah, and the, you know, Mills coming off injury, Morrison coming off injury, Collins, his tape. I mean, yeah, he's going to test well. There's, I don't think there's any doubt. And Cross is undersized, so I'm not sure that any kind of combine is going to be favorable for him.
Final question. It's a pairing here for the NCAA basketball, I believe. Greg Baseman asks, how many steps does it travel? And Lane Kiffin's burner would like to add, name a more unlikable but highly successful coach than Dan Hurley. I dare you.
Is it? I saw live the game-winning shot by Maryland. That was a tremendous end of the game, Colorado State and Maryland. But I didn't think travel until I saw a tweet this morning looking like he took three full steps. It sure didn't look like a travel life. That was an incredible shot. A guy dribbling left, big guy too, dribbling left, hard to his left, guy in his face with length, and then is still fading or going to his left in a perfect, bank shot. But I don't have a problem with Dan Hurley. I think it's, he is the best coach. I mean, at least he was the last 2 years, but let's see, who would we like less? I don't know, but I would put Kurt Cignetti in the running. Maybe Mick Cronin.
Oh yeah. Good call. Oh. that's
very possible. Kevin Willard would be really high on my list of unlikable guys.
Really?
Oh, that's God. I mean, just like do you see the clips of him complaining about, like, we needed an extra night in New York? Like, if we're going to be an elite program, like, I want the investment. Yeah. And what the best thing about Queen's game winning shot was the press conference afterwards. When somebody asked about Kevin Willard, why is he a coach that, you know, you listen to? And he said, the quote is, he did pay us the money.
Derek Queen, I think he actually said he do pay us the money.
Yeah,
he do pay us the money. He do pay us the money.
Yeah, but, Queen, who was a high school teammate of Cooper Flagg, yeah, would have been fun to watch.
There's plenty of people on here that would say the namesake of this question, Lane Kiffin, is unlikable. Now, he doesn't have a natty, so I don't know if you can call him highly successful.
Yeah, and I think the key is highly successful. Cannot. But yeah,
and I know Lane, and so, like, I actually find him very likable because he's still amusing, and he doesn't take himself too seriously most of the time, and everything he does is calculated, and that's why I don't have a problem with Kevin Willard last week, because that was great fodder for the media to say, well, I can't really discuss a contract extension because my boss is going to SMU. And as it stands right now, I can't even spend an extra night in New York with my guys for Christmas. So that didn't bother me. I would say that I see you, Dan Hurley, and I would raise you Todd Golden and Bruce Pearl. You certainly can do your own Googling and find out all the reasons. or you can just, snap some illicit pictures. And then, Jim Harbaugh? Why is this not Jim Harbaugh's burner? Jim Harbaugh's burner should be the moniker for this question. Mick Cronin blasting the NCAA.
Everything he can blast.
Chartered Allegiant Jets is the best thing I've ever heard. And John Calipari?
I was going to say.
I need to speak up quickly for Dan Hurley, which is why I included the question. That man got me 13 straight NCAA tournament covers, even in defeat, guys. Dan Hurley can do whatever he wants in my all I gotta do is watch him in March.
No, I thought it was 14 straight. I thought yesterday made it 14 straight for you, T.O. I must have.
Oh, you're right. 14 straight with the cover yesterday. There we go. See, he's the gift that keeps on giving. I just needed him for one more round. I could have gotten another cover out of the guy. Shout out to my late mom. She hated Tim Priester. You're gonna love this one. Lefty Drizzell.
Hated Tim Priester? I don't believe that.
Hated Lefty Drizzell. Remember Lefty Drizzell, Maryland?
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
Because he was giving Drizzell a choke sign when Notre Dame players were shooting free throws.
Wow.
Not sure he's ultra successful either, but no, he was pretty successful. But
how many steps does it travel? Do we get to the bottom of that one?
I know he traveled on that last last shot because there is no gather step.
Gather, but yeah, he gathered and then still took three steps.
We found out you don't get the gather in college basketball, and I'd like to point out one thing because I know Priestry agrees. You know what another word for a Euro step or gather step is, Tim?
Travel.
Yep. Travel.
I've always thought so, but I didn't, man, I just, it was a tremendous shot. I yes. didn't realize.
Oh, it was a great traveled, shot. It so. Was great. And I had no horse, no horse save, in the fight, but that's, it was.
Save the weekend. Like yeah. it was a incredibly boring.
Yes.
Oh, opening yeah. weekend yeah. of the tournament. Exactly. And that helped make it slightly memorable.
That was
I was actually
game.
Talking to somebody, cause I was in Fort Wayne during this for, anyway, I was talking to somebody when a Michigan State player kicked the ball in the game. And the guy behind me is like, that's a kick. And I go, depends on how you interpret it. I mean, in Denmark, maybe it's not a kick. And maybe in Arkansas, it is a kick. You can call it just something different. It's not a kick anymore. That's what a travel is. It's a gather step. So he took four steps and it's a gather step, right? Well, no, he gathered. All right, great. That's a travel. It's a Denmark kick. That's what I'm going to call it from now on. If you kick the ball in basketball, it's a Denmark kick. It's not a violation. Thoughts on that? We going to sign off?
That, I mean, the kick in the Michigan State game went like, more than three quarters of the court. So if that was a legit kick, he got his money's worth on that one.
That is it for us. But we have a little bit of access this week, not to practice, but there'll be plenty of interviews Wednesday, Friday, and then Saturday. We will have the defensive newcomers and early enrollees. So until then, choose to tune into IrishIllustrated.com. For Tim Priester, John Bryce, and Pete Sampson, I am Tim O'Malley. Thanks for listening.